Welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host. Thank you so much for joining us here on the program. You do know that we come your way every Sunday at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m. Monday at 1 a.m. We do stream this program at richarddugan.com, and we also archive the podcasts at richarddugan.com, the radio show's page, so that you can listen to the interviews again. We link to our guests, and we'll be giving you the website shortly so that you will be able to contact our guest, at least through the website, get more information, check out the information that our guest happens to have for you. And we're very excited to have on the program today the author of, I think, an extraordinary book. It's a book, I think, that for me, because of the fact that it deals with a particular literary, I'm going to call it an art, an artistic expression. It's not something that was really focused on in my education, so I don't have the kind of appreciation for it, in spite of the fact that in my early days in radio, when I was asked to read this type of material, they said I did really well. So what's up with that? But this is a book entitled Awakening a Leader's Soul, Learning Through Immortal Poems. Now, I am learning about the different types of poems, the styles, but also learning a greater appreciation. And obviously, our guest, Gaurav Bahula, is joining us here via Skype from the East Coast of the United States. And obviously, first of all, thank you for joining us here on the program. It's great to have you with us.
Thank you, Richard. Thank you for inviting me.
Poetry for you, obviously, is very, very important, especially concerning the fact that you've incorporated it into the context of this particular work, which to a lot of folks, when you're talking about a subject of a leadership, focusing on leadership, and as the title says, awakening a leader's soul, which we're going to get into, obviously you deemed it of great importance to incorporate that into this work.
Well, I come from India. And in India, we take our teachers or our gurus very seriously. And sometimes it's good to sort of draw on your culture just to look a little better than you are. So maybe I am looking a little better than I am. But by and large, Indians take their teachers and their gurus very seriously. Now, Percy Bysshe Shelley, the great Romantic poet, said it beautifully. He said that we cannot see ourselves unless we are reflected onto something else. What that means is we need teachers. We need teachers to help us see ourselves and hear ourselves. And the most interesting thing is that we need different teachers depending upon what stage of life we are at. The teachers that helped you understand the world, make sense of it when you were in kindergarten, cannot help you when you are a teenager. The teachers that helped you when you were a teenager can't help you when you are deciding to get married and your career and how to progress your career, etc. So we need different teachers at different stages of our lives. And I think that there is no better teacher than an immortal poem because of the fact that it's immortal. It's there forever. Mm-hmm. And it helps us see ourselves in different ways, hear ourselves in different ways. Every time you go back to the same poem, you discover a different aspect to yourself. What better teacher can there be than that?
Now, in terms of poetry, as I said, when I was in my early 20s and I was working for a particular station that broadcast to the blind and visually impaired, and of course they would record most of the materials that were broadcast. Some of it was done live, but a lot of the recordings, and they had, I mean, literally every kind of book that you could think of, whether it was fiction, nonfiction, and so forth. And every so often, a book would come along, or I was reading something and contributing to the programming. There was a poem in there, and of course, you know, I was asked to read it, as part of the recording. And even though I didn't fully understand the context of everything in it, they, for whatever reason, they said, "Well, you read that really well. It's amazing how well you read poetry." You know, out loud, this kind of thing, the presentation. And I guess it was because I look at poems in the context because of my love of music as lyrics to a song. And of course, many poems have been put to music and vice versa. But there are so many different types and styles. Obviously, you're coming from India. There are certain styles that the Indians would use in that country in the various languages that we wouldn't use in the States, or maybe that they use in Japan or in China or other parts of the world. I guess for some of us who are, we're trying to educate ourselves and, you know, understand more about other cultures and the rest of the world, it can get very confusing very fast, and we can get very overwhelmed.
Yeah, but however, I just want to make one distinction, and that is that my book uses poetry mm-hmm. to inform topics of leadership.
Yes.
It is not a book of poetry. So had it been a book of poetry, maybe we could draw distinctions between the haiku or
sure.
you know the chapai from India or the sonnet, etc. Mm-hmm. However, it is not a book on poetry or about poetry.
No.
It is a book about leadership.
No, I do understand that.
I use poems to inform various topics of leadership.
Mm-hmm.
And so the poems really are a means of helping us go deeper into that aspect of leadership.
Have to add emphasis.
I'm sorry?
Help to add emphasis to the text of the work itself.
You're right. Add emphasis, amplify, elaborate, help explain in a different way so that we can develop different perspectives. Exactly right.
So let's talk about this aspect of leadership and awakening a leader's soul, the title of this particular work that we're talking about. And you have been very prolific in the works in your writings, whether it's novels or screenplays or works such as this. The aspect of leadership, when I first became a manager at a radio station, I tried a particular leadership style. It was not something that I was taught. I didn't go to school to learn it. It was just something that I did. And what I found was it didn't work. And it was the highly authoritarian style of leadership that says, I'm the boss, and you're going to do it because I said to do it. Now, I referred to it as my Hitlerian phase, okay? Mm-hmm. And I found out that because I got challenged by one of my employees and or coworkers, really, because we were all really doing the same work. I just happened to have the title. He says, I'm not going to do it because you want me to do it. So I thought about that for a moment, and I came back and I said, well, and I came from a different tact, not because I wanted him to do it, but more because it needed to be done for even the rest of the staff and so forth and so on. And then he did it. And we began to develop a better relationship after that as well. I also, as I say, I gave up that form of management style, if you will, because I found it didn't work. And yet I see that kind of style in a lot of workplaces where they just want to micromanage. They want to control every move you make. And that's not to say that in our technological age, we don't have people that are sitting in front of their computers going places they shouldn't be going, including social media, instead of doing the job that they were hired to do. So how does one begin the process of awakening that soul within the leader, or even determining whether or not they have the leadership qualities, capacity, if you will, to be a leader?
Well, what you have just said is exactly the problem, in the sense that the moment you start talking about leadership, it's like people get off on their horses and they just charge off in different directions, you know, and they start talking about leadership styles, leadership personalities, the fact that we just can't get good workers these days and people are not motivated and they are goofing off at work on, when they're on their jobs, etc. Well, let's just say that all of it or none of it may be true, and there's a partial truth in everything. However, my purpose is not to talk about leadership styles or leadership personalities, because the thesis of the book is we are suffering, we are experiencing a perennial cycle, 24/7, 365 days a year, of what I call leadership crises. Every single day when you turn to the media, you find some company or the other sacrificing either their customers or their suppliers or their communities or the environment for their own personal gains of sales and profits. Now, clearly, there's something wrong with that picture because there's not a single company in this world that advertises. We love to exploit our customers. We love to take advantage of our communities. We love to damage the planet. Nobody says that, but they do it. So here's the deal. It's not as if they didn't go to school. It's not as if they didn't go to college. It's not as if they didn't have education. What's happening is that we have overemphasized the brilliance of the executive mind and totally forgotten that there is a human being that is actually implementing what's in the head. And that's why I call the title says Awakening a Leader's Soul, because the thesis of the book is that in today's complex and uncertain world, where truth is not just a matter of yes, no, agree, disagree, black and white, 1-0, the truth always lies in what I would call the murky middle, in between extremes. And to wade into that extreme, to find what is the most optimal solution, just like you had to find out that you just couldn't give orders. What's more important, the single biggest asset of a leader is their humanity, who they are, what they stand for, what they're willing to fight for, what they're willing to walk away from. Executive brilliance is important, but it's not enough. So, it's the humanity of the leader that actually implements that what's in the head, and what's in the leader, that soul of the leader, is wiser and smarter than what's in the head.
Is that which you refer to that's in the leader in all of us, that we could all be leaders? We could all awaken that part of us, that humanity within us? Or are there people who have a greater capacity for that than others? And in other words, we all can't be leaders because there also have to be followers. If there's going to be a leader, there's got to be a follower. And if there are followers, there has to be a leader.
That's right. If you take the conventional view of leadership, and that is that there's somebody in front and there are tons of people at the back. However, that's not how the book conceptualizes leadership.
Okay.
How it conceptualizes leadership is very simply this. It says, if a human being has access to power, privilege, or resources that can influence the well-being and prosperity of even one individual, then that person is a leader in that sphere. So a mother is a leader because she controls power, privilege, and resources that can influence the well-being and prosperity of her child. Would you agree with that?
I would. I had never considered parenthood to be a leadership role, but until now. But it is.
Okay.
You're right.
And that is why this book talks about reimagining leadership and leadership's purpose. So the whole idea is not the fact that everybody doesn't have the capacity. There is a brilliant guru in India called Raman Maharishi, and he has a wonderful analogy. He says if you take some coal and you divide it up into three parts, and one is very, very dry, and the other is damp, and the third is soaking wet. He says, which pile will ignite the fastest? Clearly, that's a no-brainer, the one that's totally dry. And the one that's soaking wet will take a long, long time to ignite. Well, that's exactly the case with human beings. If you take any scripture, any tradition, any culture, the first thing they all tell you is, wake up. Don't go through life asleep. So if you are awake, and you understand how your words, your thoughts, your actions, your behavior impacts the well-being and prosperity of others, then you will be more willing to lead with your humanity as opposed to just your mind.
Do you think that in the West, our media misrepresents corporate leadership in this context, that maybe these particular CEOs and, you know, whatever titles you want to give to them, leaders of business and industry, are really more benevolent than the media portrays them? Or are we getting a fairly accurate portrayal, if you will, from the media? Because unless I work in that company and I work for that CEO or that leader, and I have one-on-one exchange and experience, I don't know if that guy is a Scrooge or a kind-hearted, benevolent a supporter of the workers that are making the money for him.
Well, I think that right there is the problem, because what does the media do? They love labels, correct?
Yes.
Someone's a Scrooge, someone's not a Scrooge. Someone is a despot, and someone is a kind-hearted, benevolent soul, to use your expression. But I'm saying that is incorrect, because leadership requires you to be Hitler on one day and to be, you know, Jesus Christ on the next day. If you can't, then you cannot be an effective leader. Mm. I'm sorry. There's not a single leader on this planet who has been successful, who is picture perfect, who fits into one box. That is exactly the antithesis of soulful leadership, which is the theme of the book. Mm-hmm. Soulful leadership says that every leadership decision involves a sacrifice. I challenge you to come up with even a single leadership decision that doesn't involve a sacrifice. You're always sacrificing someone's interests. You're always sacrificing someone, some resources, some position of privilege or lack of it. So the question then becomes, who are you sacrificing and why and when? If you can honestly answer those questions and demonstrate that your decisions are actually increasing the well-being and prosperity of the aggregate, then you've done your job, no matter how imperfect it is. And that's why we have that brilliant poem by Leonard Cohen, "Ring the bell that still can ring. Forget your perfect offering. There's a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in." We are all cracked human beings. Mm-hmm. There is no perfect human being, including the leaders.
You also talk about something that we have been focused on for many years on this program, especially dealing with coming up with the new ways of living, the new ways of working, the new ways of playing, if you will, so that we all can thrive. I think that what I find a little disconcerting, because again, I acknowledge the fact that I'm only getting a small picture from radio and television and newspapers, a small picture of what's really going on. That's what I find so interesting when particular outlets, they want to get the scoop on everybody else about a story, and they misrepresent, or they didn't have all of the picture, but they have already set up a scenario in the mind of the viewer about this particular story. And then a few days later, they manage to get more information, but that mindset's already been set in the mind of the viewer or the listener. And now they, you know, it's like it's almost impossible to backpedal. But in terms of these new teachers, I mean, you obviously you're one of them, one of the new teachers of this new form of leadership, because we honestly, we do. Would you agree that we absolutely need leaders to move us forward, to help us to evolve as a species, as a society, correct?
Well, first of all, thank you for the kind words. I really appreciate that compliment. Now, there isn't a single author who wouldn't say, oh, my book is great, my book is good. So I think that it's one thing if I say the book is good, but I just want to help you understand that there is an organization called Forward Reviews. They're one of America's premier book review organizations and mm-hmm. agencies. And this is what Forward Reviews said about the book. They said the reason why Awakening a Leader's Soul resonates so strongly is because the world needs more of the type of leaders that the book wants to create. Mm-hmm. Now, I could not agree with that more. We need more soulful leadership. But let me go back to that media aspect of yours. The reason why we are all the time grappling with this sort of tension of is it good, is it bad, is it right, is it wrong, is because, first of all, we are still stuck in dichotomies. The world is no longer a dichotomy. It is so complex, so uncertain, that anybody who's thinking in terms of dichotomies is living in a very, very different kind of an era, and they really need to wake up and transport themselves to the 21st century. We live in an and world. It's right and wrong. It's right and right. Mm-hmm. It's wrong and less wrong. Mm-hmm. We don't live in an or world anymore. It's not right or wrong, one or zero. The other thing that I think is very, very important to understand is that every time the media covers a story, They'll always find that one person or those two people or those three people who somehow have been left out of the decision. Now, with all due respect, that is that is such what I would call low-lying journalism that I don't even want to talk about it, because Kenneth Arrow has already won the Nobel Prize. Anybody and everybody in the world who has lived in a family knows there is no way on God's sweet earth that you can satisfy everybody's needs. Mm-hmm. I'm sure you grew up in a family. Your mother made some very tasty food. One person in the family didn't like it. What does that mean? Does that mean that your mother should give up cooking that dish? Okay. The Kenneth Arrow has already demonstrated that the moment you go from two to three people in a room, you can't satisfy everybody's needs. So it's not everybody. That's why I keep using the word the greatest majority, because Shakespeare said, all the world's a stage. We have our entrances, we have our exits. Leadership is also a stage. Leaders enter, leaders exit. And at the end of the leadership journey, the people ask the leader, hey, skipper, are we better off? And if the skipper can't say yes with some authority, or if the skipper can't say yes, you are better off for these reasons, or if all that the skipper can say is, I'm better off, I don't know about you, then I think leadership is failing its purpose.
I know that to use a baseball analogy, that and baseball is actually the only sport and business in which a player can be productive one third of the time. If you were that level of productivity in your work, in your family, in your personal life, you're it's a mess. You would never survive. You couldn't do it. And yet to bat 300 in baseball, oh my gosh, this guy's doing fantastic just because of the odds and all of the other variables in that particular sport. So in terms of success and failure of a leader, and this is why I asked the question, should we all aspire to be leaders? Because maybe some of us, we aren't designed. It's not in our DNA, if you will, to take on a leadership role at that level. And again, this is beyond parenthood. I mean, if you're a parent, you're a leader because that's part of your job. And I like the analogy you used, because immediately I flashed to my brother and four sisters and my parents at dinner. And yes, invariably there was someone who didn't care much for the cauliflower puree, you know, kind of thing. It would happen. And then there would be commentary at the table. I mean, I even remember once where one of my siblings said to my father, after my father requested that they, would they please get up and get the bowl of whatever it was that he wanted, they responded to him, I couldn't believe this, and I'm surprised my dad didn't knock him across the room, well, who broke your legs? And my dad just, and this goes to my father's ability to maintain his composure and understand that this is a child, and that this was a child of maybe 13, 14, who is speaking out from wherever they're coming from, and it wasn't meant as a personal attack to my dad or a defiance per se. Other stuff was going on, that he just kind of gave him the look like, you know, would you please just go, I just asked you please to go get that for me. Would you please just do it? Oh, and he did, and the sibling did, but that's one of the interesting aspects in business. I mean, I've worked for a number of different companies. I've worked for a number of different managers at different radio stations, and I wanted to ask you about this in terms of bringing humanity, the human factor, and I think that when you say it's both and, it's you know, it's the hard nose with the soft heart ability of a leader to really lead. And I found that in a lot of the instances where I had the greatest time, it was where I felt like I was part of a family, but it wasn't like I could just get away with whatever I wanted. There were certain rules that you had to abide by. And I did. I didn't have a problem with that. And Would you say that if you come into a company where the employees or all of the workers, the employer and the employees, all feel as though this is a great place to work? Yeah, we have our problems, but overall, you know, I enjoy getting up in the morning and coming to work, and I hate leaving sometimes because we really enjoy what we do. Do you find that there are many workplaces like that around the country, and is this problem systemic around the world as far as our lack of genuine leadership, as you're speaking of it, in terms of this bringing the humanity into it?
Well, first of all, I don't want to sound like a crusty curmudgeon. Yes, there are workplaces in this world that absolutely are a joy for the people who work there. They feel like family. And actually, I discuss a very interesting case study, which, by the way, has become a very important Harvard case study. It's about the attack on the Taj Hotel in Mumbai, and as to how the employees were willing to risk their lives for the hotel because they didn't think of it as Ratan Tata's hotel. They didn't think of it as the Taj Palace or the Taj Hotel. They thought of it as their hotel. Mm. And so that's a classic example, a case study where under dire circumstances, people were willing to sacrifice their own lives for the well-being of the company, which doesn't happen very often. However, I want to go back to your earlier comment on baseball and then trace it all the way back. And there is an essay in my book on perspective. The reason why we are able to tolerate or even celebrate that person who's batting 0.3 or 300, whatever the expression is, is because there's a certain perspective, because you understand baseball. Now, there has to be perspective even in the workplace. If the perspective is that no matter what, everybody should get a promotion, everybody should get a raise, everybody should be, you know, the next, or should have a reserve parking spot, etc., regardless of whether they have put in the effort, regardless of whether they have done as well as they should have, then I think that's an unrealistic expectation. There's something wrong with that perspective. And this whole notion of should everybody aspire to be a leader, I never will go anywhere near that. No, we should not aspire to be leaders, but we should aspire to think, talk, and act with our wiser selves, which is our humanity, so that we can make the best use of the power, the privilege, and the resources that have been given to us. And in the process, if we become soulful leaders, wonderful. And if we have 25 people reporting to us, great. And in the process, if we become leaders and we only have 5 people reporting to us, still great, because the well-being and prosperity of those 5 people is still very important. And, you know, is it systemic? Yes and no. It's systemic in the sense that it's a constant concern. It has to be a constant concern, and which is why I wrote the book, because we cannot just sort of sit back and assume that just because we have places called Harvard and Stanford and Wharton and MIT and Yale, and they run all these fabulous leadership development programs, that all's hunky-dory with the world. On the contrary, close to about $50 billion are spent on leadership development throughout the world. Depending upon whose statistics you believe, America alone spends upwards of $10 billion. If that's the case, if all that was required was these leadership development programs that attended to the mind of the executive, then how do you explain Wells Fargo? How do you explain Equifax? How do you explain Volkswagen? How do you explain Takeda? How do you explain Princess Cruise Lines? And I could go on and on and on. Valdez, Exxon, BP. How do you explain all that? These were leadership failures of the highest order, where someone in a leadership position took a conscious decision that they were going to abandon the well-being and prosperity of either their customers, the communities, or the planet. So yes, it's systemic. And no, it's not systemic, because we also have places in the world, B corporations, recently Fortune has come up with the Fortune 50, companies that are changing the world, where people want to go to work for those companies. They feel excited about their jobs, and they feel excited about supporting the causes that their companies represent. So yes, it's a systemic problem, and no, it's not a systemic problem. There are companies that have demonstrated that you can achieve both.
I have seen some news stories about companies, one in particular, it's a yogurt manufacturer, actually started by an immigrant, a gentleman who moved here from another country. And at one point, after moving the plant from one part of the country to the other and bringing workers in who were working for a factory that occupied the same building that he was buying and basically offered these jobs and everything, after a number of years, he actually gave them, I think it was 49% stock options or ownership in the company. As employees, as part of their package, they were co-owners with him in this venture.
Are you talking about Dasani?
That could be. That very well could be. It's a yogurt manufacturer, and the other aspect of it too is that I've worked, as I say, as a manager in several stations, more operations as opposed to general, but nonetheless. And I have to say that my frustrations always came from people who would come in and complain about whatever it was that they complained about the station. Oh, my God, these chairs, they're awful. And the windscreens on the microphones and the this and the that and the that. It was always, and I always took umbrage with that because this is, I'm here 8 hours a day, 5 days a week. This is my home. If I came into your home and started criticizing your carpets and your drapes and the covering on your walls and on and on and on, you wouldn't care for that much, would you? And I don't care for that when people come into my place of employment, where, as I said, I spend a third of my day, 5 days a week, and sometimes more. It's frustrating for me, but I kind of have to hold my tongue because most of these folks are the ones who are paying my salary.
And well, I would also like to bring it to your attention that, and I'm not trying to knock anyone, but mm-hmm. I've been an entrepreneur now since 1990. That's what, 27 plus years? Mm-hmm. And that's infinitely longer than most people survive. And I always maintain that, you know, there is a, what I would call an employee mentality and there's an owner mentality. And I can assure you that immigrant gentleman who started a yogurt company, a yogurt brand, and I'm pretty sure it's Dasani because I've read the same story myself. Mm-hmm. He gave 49% to his workers because they probably came in every day and worked with what I would call an owner's mentality. Mm. It was their company, not just his company. And how did it get to that point? That is the real most important thing. How did he manage to inculcate that spirit in them? That is what is never taught.
Yeah.
Because people, you can't see it. You can only sense it. You can feel it. It's after the fact. It's post hoc. And I'll just share a simple example with you where, you know, and this is not to blow my own trumpet or thump my own chest, etc. But when I was running my company, and especially in today's day and age when there's so much talk about healthcare, I always used to tell people that, you know, if you ask me, what is the one thing that I'm the happiest about? What is my one achievement that I feel most, you know, happy about? I don't like to use the word proud because I come from a culture that doesn't favor that word. Mm-hmm. So I hesitate whenever I come to that P word. I would have to say to you that from day one, the company paid healthcare for every one of its employees and their dependents, no matter what their rank was. Every single employee and dependent, their healthcare was paid for by the company. It was a decision I made on day one, and I stuck to it through thick and thin. And there were many other things, you know, like when we brought lunch in, we brought lunches for everybody, not just for the executives. Or when we had corporate parties, everybody was invited, etc. When we had if bonuses were declared, everybody got a bonus. So the point I'm trying to make to you is that it is possible to run a company with what I would call an awakened mindset.
Yeah.
Which sort of keeps in perspective that the well-being and prosperity of the people that are working there, that are working with the company, is really the main purpose of the leadership journey. It's not the power, the privilege, and the prestige of the CEO. I mean, that's all incidental.
In the early 90s, there was a news story that came across the airwaves, and it was regarding a company, actually, I'm going to name the company, Motorola. And at that time, the company was basically laying off approximately, I want to say 1,000 people. There may be less than that, but nonetheless, just for number's sake. And the story went on that the reason why they were laying off this 1,000 people was because they found out that over the past year, though they could not identify the individuals involved, over $1 million in materials had disappeared from the plant. And I sit around here at the stations that I've worked for and the one I work for now, and that is a constant reminder to me that when I take, and I mean take, the conscious effort to steal something from my employer, I'm not just stealing from them. I'm taking from myself. And if I wind out on the street, who else do I have to blame but myself? So then this is the philosophy I learned many years ago. Have you address this as well before we go to break. And that is that when a client comes in, it is not my job to make the radio station successful. It is my job to make that customer successful, and that makes the radio station successful. And to me, that is also something that I'm not sure is really taught, because we kind of go back to what we shared at the beginning of the program about the current model is, you know, basically the bottom line and making sure that you've got money coming in for the shareholders.
I would say that in majority of the cases now, I'm sure you're very well aware that there is a lot of talk in the corporate world about the triple bottom line, you know, people, profits, people, planet, and the profit. In that order, mm-hmm. Preferably. But, you know, there are some people who still haven't bought into that. And there are some people who still believe that sales and profits are the ultimate God. I mean, you did have Milton Friedman, one of the most powerful economists of his time, saying that everything else other than profits was all, you know, just hogwash. So people in the most powerful places today, and I, why are we going in the past? I mean, why don't we just stay in the present and look at all the proclamations that are being passed against the environment, you know, the withdrawal from the Paris Climate Accord and so many other kinds of decisions that are being taken in the interests of big business and against the interests of others. I mean, they all are indicative of where people's preferences and priorities lie and what they value. Mm. And so, you know, it's a long climb. It's a very long climb and a very steep one.
Indeed, indeed. My guest is Gaurav Bahla, and we are talking about his book, his latest work. And I find this fascinating. We're going to continue talking about Awakening a Leader's Soul. And it's basically we're going to talk about Awakening a Leader's Soul Learns Through Immortal Poems. And we are talking about this whole aspect of leadership. This is something that I'm still working on to this day, because it's not just other people that need leadership and that need to be led. We as individuals, I need to be led. And we're going to talk a little bit about that when we get back in just a moment. I'm Richard Dugan. This is Tell Me Your Story. Stay tuned.
Tell me your stories. I'll do my best to understand you.
Welcome back to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host. Thanks for staying with us here on the program. I'm Richard Dugan. Again, we're joined by the author of the book, Awakening a Leader's Soul, Learning Through Immortal Poems. And Gaurav Bahla, I want to thank you so much for staying with us here on the program. I'm curious about an aspect of all of this that you brought to my mind at the end of the last segment, having to do with an individual's if we can say this, sort of self-leadership and coming from that perspective, how does our actual soul, our inner self, who and what we really are, as the great wisdom teachings from around the world and from centuries gone by speaks to, and I'm curious as to that in connection with, and maybe it's the same thing, using our intuition, that still small voice, or some would even say the gut feeling or sensation, to guide us through as we move through our days and weeks and months and years in life.
Well, first of all, I just want to say one thing, because I want to make this very clear, that just because I wrote this book doesn't mean that I myself am blemishless or that I've arrived. No, I'm still a work in progress. In fact, I want to share with you something that I don't think I've shared on air with anybody other than my circle of friends and family. That's when I was writing this book, it was a very tough endeavor. Every day I would write the book, and by the evening I would be literally shattered to bits, because just like like Shelley said, we can't see ourselves till we are reflected onto something. So as I was writing, I was also looking at myself in the mirror, and I was getting a different perspective on myself. And I kept saying to myself, I said, is this who I really am? And if I'm not what I'm writing about, what, do I have the right to write this book? Do I have the right to complete this book? But also there was a voice within me that kept saying, go on, keep writing, don't stop, you know. And so I listened to both voices till one day it became very, very clear to me as to why I was writing the book. And it came to me in a single sentence. It said, this is the education I never had. And so the book was an education to myself. And I hope it'll complete the education of a lot of other people who've been to some of the most prestigious business schools, but there's a hole in their learning. And that hole is about themselves, who they are, what they stand for, what they're willing to fight for, and what they're willing to walk away from, their own humanity. And I'm afraid that the most prestigious business schools, the most prestigious universities don't do a very good job at getting us connected with our own humanity.
Well, I would tend to agree with you on that. I don't know necessarily that there's anyone necessarily to blame per se, but certainly my education was deficient of so many things. Just doing these programs, I have learned so much about mythology. We did an entire series 3 years ago on mythology over the course of 12 months, as well as I'm learning more, especially in reading your book, about not only the appreciation, but also the understanding and the connection that you bring through the poetic expressions within the book, and so many other things. Now, you also have a PhD, and I'm wondering, sometimes I wonder, because since I've been working at this particular station for the last 11 years, or 10 years, what have you, I've run across and been associated with more people with PhDs or who are going after them. I've even attended a defense of the thesis by one of my friends here who got their PhD, and I actually jokingly said, "Why do you need to defend it?" And obviously, when I attended, I understood that what it was about. But why do you see, in terms of education, and especially in terms of education to create leaders, can you speak to other schools, or maybe some of the more prestigious schools, I don't know, you would know better than I, that are beginning the process of starting to teach some of these things that you talk about in your book?
Well, I would be lying to you if I was to tell you that I would know, but you started down a very interesting path, and then you suddenly switched lanes. When you started talking about the PhD, and I thought for a moment you were going to ask me, do you think your PhD is an asset or is it a liability? And I have to tell you that there's not a single day that has passed since I have got my PhD that I haven't asked myself that same question. Is it an asset or is it a liability? And some days it's an asset and some days it's a liability. And one has to be very awake and alive to the situation that, you know, they have those three funny letters after their name. And as long as those three funny letters are not interfering in my ability to learn and to keep growing as an individual, it's fine. But if they start interfering with my ability to learn and to act and to grow, then I think we have a major problem.
Well, actually,
as far as the schools are concerned, I really wouldn't know. I only know about one school because I'm associated with it. And I can tell you with some authority about what their perspective is. So I live in Reston, Virginia, just outside of Washington, D.C. And we have one of the great universities in USA, Georgetown University, located here. And I'm associated with them. I'm their adjunct faculty. And as you probably know, or you may not know, but Georgetown is run by Jesuits. And there is the Jesuit tradition. And I grew up in the Jesuit tradition, as a matter of fact, even before I came to the U.S. I'm a product of St. Xavier's High School in New Delhi, or in Delhi, rather, which was in the older part of Delhi. So I grew up with the Jesuits. So I know the Jesuit system intimately ever since my childhood days. And the Jesuits value education a lot. In fact, there could be a absolute dead heat between the Indians and the Jesuits in terms of who values education more. And they are very, very concerned that they not just produce what they call, you know, business robots, that they produce leaders with humanity, people who understand that the mind is important, but so is how they use that mind and how they do well for their business and how they do well for the world. And Georgetown is one of the few schools that I know that has started some very interesting practices, like they have a weekly meditation hour, they have regular programs on how business can help make the world a better place, etc. So there is, and I'm sure there are other schools. I'm sure there are others. I just don't know about them. Mm-hmm. So I do not want to be unfair to anybody, but all that I know is that at Georgetown, we are definitely making a conscious attempt to help people understand that the blind pursuit of trying to get to the top is going to lead to a very empty existence. And if someone really wants to lead a rich, fulfilling, meaningful, worthwhile life, then they have to put work success in perspective and integrate it with all of life's success and not just, you know, what they do those 8 or 9 or 10 hours that they are in the workplace.
And actually, the question that I was going to ask regarding your PhD was why you thought it was important to have it.
Now you're asking me to bring out some skeletons from the closet that I do not want to.
That's fine. The program is designed in such a way that you answer the questions that you like. I don't find that there's a problem with that because not everybody.
All that I can tell you is I was a young, stupid, arrogant, highly successful group product manager at Nestle. I was doing very well. And like I said, I was a bit immature and stupid and arrogant. I mean, what else can you expect from someone who's in their 20s? And one fine day, I just decided that I was going to go and learn so much so that there would be no doubt in anyone's mind as to who was the smartest guy in the room. Now, over the years, I've learned that smarts is not enough, which is why one reason I wrote this book. As a matter of fact, there's a very interesting movie on the smartest men in the room about Enron. And we all know what those smart guys did and how much havoc they created. So business smarts is not enough. But since you asked me the question, I'm giving you an honest answer. It was just one of those hot-headed decisions by a guy in his mid-20s. Who said, I have nothing to lose, and if I want to do it, this is the time. Otherwise, it's going to get too late, and so why not do it? Because the story of my life has been about experimentation and about learning and about traveling down different paths. And I have made mistakes, but they are my mistakes.
I also do a lot of, and this is internal, comparing myself and my level of achievement at the age of 57 to other folks who, like yourself, you've written your book. I'm still working on the book that I started in 2001. And I'm not writing War and Peace. It's not the great American novel. It's a very simple little book. And for whatever reason, I've come up with enough excuses to not finish the darn thing. But I made the promise at the beginning of 2017 that I would. And I still haven't sat down yet as of our conversation to go through. And as I said, it's not more than maybe 20, 25, 30 pages long.
Well, Richard Dugan, you're only 57. You're a kid. That's all I can say.
makes me feel very good, especially considering the fact that I happen to own a Volvo. It's the first one I've ever owned, and when it was under 100,000 miles, and people would ask me about the car and how's it doing and blah blah blah, and then they'd ask the mileage, and I tell them it was under 100,000. Oh, you haven't even broken it in yet. And I thought, wow, any other car, they'd say, oh my, you need to trade that sucker in and get something newer, you know. So I feel pretty good that I don't need to be traded in just yet. And besides, as I've shared before on this program, my great-grandmother on my mother's side, who lived to be 100 years of age, at the age of 95 at a family reunion, I was telling people I was going to outlive her. And as the years went by and we would get together for reunions, I'd say, and to that statement, and she's making it really hard. So I've got a good 42, 43 years to go, a minimum, assuming that things go the way that we'd like them to go and life progresses and we're able to be successful and do the things that we want to do. But I have to tell you that more than anything else, that aspect of success has less to do with the things and the money and the position and the, if you will, the power and all of those things, and more making sure that I'm doing what I enjoy doing, like our conversation here. And I know that, for example, when we had that economic downturn back in 2008, this also kind of shocked me in regards to the downturn. They were saying from all of the financial quarters, the experts were saying, we've never been down this road before. And then they started using the solutions from days gone by for solving the problem they were saying we'd never seen before. And I thought, that doesn't make any sense. Why would you use the solutions for an old problem, you know, for older problems that have gone that are decades old, for a situation that we have never seen before, according to you, you know? That was the first part of it. But getting to this aspect of leadership and self-leadership, if you will, soulful and self-leadership, the hundreds of thousands of people who lost their jobs in that short time back in the last decade, one of the first thoughts that came to my mind, Gaurav, was that how many of those people hated the job they were doing and that they had just gotten stuck? And mm-hmm. that now, like yourself, of course, you're going back to the 90s with your entrepreneurism. These folks sort of began to see that I have a second chance here. I now can maybe go and do something that my father and his father and his father before him never did, but this is what's going to make me happy. And that's kind of where the success factor comes in. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure, I can. Couple of things. First of all, you were talking about, you know, the depression or the recession, mm-hmm. and people using old solutions to solve new problems. I have a brilliant book sitting on my desk, on my bookshelf. It's called The Tyranny of Dead Ideas. And that's exactly who we are sometimes as a people. We have this set of, you know, like a little chest, the war chest that you sometimes see in Treasure Island in those old pirate movies.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know? And, and we have these creaky old hinges and locks. And every time we come up into a run into a solution, we open that chest and it creaks the hell out. It's musty, dusty, damp. And we pull out these solutions that ostensibly worked or did not work sometime. But those are the only ones we remember because, again, we are loath to experiment. And so it's a very interesting essay that I have sitting on my desk. It says, same choices, same results. So, you know, but of course that assumes that the environment remains the same, because if you exercise the same choices in an environment that has dramatically changed, you're not going to get any results, okay, leave alone same results. The second thing is I can relate intimately to what you're saying because I was one of those people affected by that era, 2008, 2009, and I have no desire to go into my own story, but the point is I had to reinvent myself. I was caught in a perfect trifecta. There was this economic downturn, and from this very high perch, I was back the ground level where I had to reconsider and rethink about reinventing myself. I was over 50. Actually, I was over 55. And you know how the world is. Somehow they think that when you're over 55, no, I was not yet 55, a couple of years younger. But somehow they think that when you're over 50 or approaching 55, that somehow you've lost your marbles. You're somehow not as good. And I believe that I am better than I ever have been because of my perspective, my maturity, the way I can sort of deal with adversity, the way I can deal with positive outcomes and not get too excited or too depressed and continue and persevere. I think I'm so much better off than when I was, 10, 15 years ago. And lastly, there was this real crash in the real estate, and I had a truckload of real estate holdings and all of which came up pretty empty. So, I've lived through that. And so all that I can say is one sentence. And Winston Churchill and Britain have demonstrated that brilliantly at the start of World War II, I beg your pardon, when Britain was on the verge of catapulting. And Churchill said, if you're going through hell, keep going. And you have to persevere. There is no substitute for perseverance. You just have to keep going and believe that, in that movement, somehow the solution or the remedy will appear. And then the last thing that you talked about was this concept of success. I think that's a real problem. That word, that one word, success, is a real problem, because if I had started thinking about success and failure by all imagination, I would have branded myself as a failure post-2009, because I was no longer in that rarefied environment. And as a matter of fact, to be totally honest, yeah, there are days when I woke up and I said, what a damn failure I've been. And then I have to remind myself that failure is only when you stop trying. And as long as you're walking and attempting and doing things, you're not failed. So I want to read to you, with your permission, since my poems is such an important part of this whole concept of enlightened, awakened, soulful leadership. I want to read to you a small poem by Ralph Waldo Emerson, which is called Success. And this is how it goes. To laugh often and much, to win the respect of intelligent people and the affection of children, to earn the appreciation of honest critics and endure the betrayal of false friends, to appreciate beauty, to find the best in others, to leave the world a bit better, whether by a healthy child, a garden patch, or a redeemed social condition, to know even one life has breathed easier because you have lived, this is to have succeeded. So I sometimes think we have very myopic perspectives on success. We equate it to material success and nothing else. And that, in my opinion, leads to such an imbalanced life. It's almost like you're going to the gym and doing nothing but, dumbbell curls to strengthen your biceps. I mean, what would you look like at the end of that? Pretty lopsided, right?
Yeah.
So, so I'm not saying I have anything against money. I'd love a lot more of it. But does that mean that just getting it is enough? I don't think so. I don't think that leads to a richer, more meaningful, more worthwhile, a deeper life where you really feel satisfied that you've achieved something. And as far as your book is concerned, Richard, I have a very simple piece of advice for you. go to Home Depot, buy the largest piece of duct tape that you can find. Tape your backside to the chair, write till you have finished, and don't get up till you have not finished writing.
That's probably the most unusual, probably the best advice I have been given thus far. And I'm certainly, I don't know that I'll go necessarily the duct tape route, although they got some pretty strenuous duct tape too. But it probably wouldn't be a bad idea. And it's like I said, it's not a complicated concept that we're putting together in this particular work. But I know that as I've shared bits and pieces with people, they've said, yeah, you need to get that thing going. You really need to get that thing out there. I'm very glad, though, that you have got you have put your book out, Awakening a Leader's Soul. Basically learns through immortal poems, and we are very grateful for the time that you have given us here on the program. This is something that there's no question. I mean, I'm in agreement with you, especially in light of the fact that this is out there. You have this made this available to people that we are in such desperate need right now of quality leadership. In all quarters, I'm not even going to start listing the various areas, just in every part of our society and our civilization. Because I don't know about you, maybe you have a quite an optimistic view of our future, but there are those who really think that, you know, we've already crossed the tipping point, and basically now we just now have to have the good sense to roll over and die. Because we have so messed ourselves up, messed up the planet, messed up our societies and our people, and on and on and on, that, you know, there are some folks who just don't see any hope left. And how about you? I mean, obviously, you must be, otherwise you wouldn't have put this out there.
There's a very profound saying in the Vedas, which are India's ancient scriptures. It says, optimist, pessimist, it's all a mist. The only time when there's no mist is when you're a realist. So I am all about realism. And I come from the business world, and strategy is my forte. And in strategy, we have a very simple saying, wherever there's angst, there's opportunity. So yes, there's a lot of angst around, but there are also lots of opportunities around. It just depends on what we focus on. Mm. So I'm hell-bent on focusing on the opportunities to make leadership a better platform for creating greater well-being and prosperity for this world, for reimagining the purpose of leadership, for articulating a new narrative on it, a more human-centric narrative. So right now, I am pursuing opportunities with the energy of a teenager.
Well, we're excited about that fact, and you're coming across that way as well. And we're very grateful, as I say, that you are sharing these ideas with us, as well as through the websites that you have available. Folks, you can find out more about our guest, Agurav Hulbala. And it is basically the name GAURAVBHALLA.com. That's GAURAVBHALLA.com. You can also find out more about this whole aspect of the book and leadership through the book. I would highly recommend that you go to soulfulleadershipworld.com. And am I correct? It's CC?
No, it's actually soulfulleadership.world.
Dot world. Okay.
Yeah, or it's soulfulleadership.com also.
Okay.
But there is actually a simpler way, Richard. And of course, it's very important that people remember the name of the book,
yes.
Awakening a Leader's Soul, Learnings Through Immortal Poems. And then you have my name, GAURAV, Gaurav Bhalla, BHALLA. And if you go to Amazon, you'll find the book there. You also find my author's page there. And Richard, I'm not boasting. I'm merely sharing that as of today, we have 25 five-star reviews and counting. So the book has been very well received by mainline book review agencies. And it has also been very well received by readers like you and I. So I think that your listeners will benefit a lot by visiting Amazon.com and reading the comments and the reviews of other people who have read the book and have enjoyed it.
Just from our conversation alone, I can highly recommend it, because it's this subject is extremely important. And again, we are exhibiting, again, I hadn't thought about it until you brought this into the conversation, that parenting is a form of leadership, and that if we aren't good leaders to our children, what do we expect them to be when they grow up? I mean, you know, that's, you know, as a, you know, the way that you raise up a child is the way that he's going to go, to paraphrase an Old Testament passage. So we need to begin that process. And as I said, there's a lot that was left out of my own personal education, the traditional primary, secondary, and post-secondary. But at the same time, since then, I have continued to be educated through the people who have come into my life, especially through the radio stations I've worked for, including this one, and this radio program through folks such as yourself. You are, there is no question, for me, you are one of my teachers. And I am greatly appreciative of the textbook that you have made available as well. So again, I want to thank you so much. Before we let you go, I want to first of all ask you if you should find yourself out on the West Coast, in the Central Valley or Central Coast, I should say, of Santa Barbara. We'd love to have you in studio to continue this conversation.
I would definitely welcome the opportunity, and if I may just ask you to not call it a textbook, call it a manifesto instead. We don't want to scare people thinking that they're going to school or college. It's a manifesto. It's a visionary leadership manifesto for the 21st century. That's what it is.
I love it.
But I would be delighted to be in the studio with you and understand how your business works and be a part of this program again. It would make me very happy.
We will do that. I guarantee you, you will be back in 2018. We're going to have you back because this is a never-ending tale of opportunities for people to be successful. And I love the Emerson poem that you quoted, that you read regarding that aspect of success. So again, we will look forward to that great opportunity to have you in. And whether we have you on Skype or on the phone or in studio, we will have you back probably in early 2018 to continue talking about this. And then before I let you go, as I do with all of my guests, I have three final questions for you. And you may have addressed these throughout the interview, but I'm going to ask them point blank to you at this particular point. And if I can get this correct, who is Gaurav Balhala?
Gaurav Balhala is a traveler. He is committed to the human condition. He is committed to learning, to acting on that learning, and to growing as an individual in all aspects of his life, whether it's as a professional, whether it's in terms of his family and his child, or his wife, or his friends, his colleagues, the world that he lives in. So I'm essentially a traveler. I am traveling, I'm learning, I'm acting on that learning, and I'm growing. That's who I am.
What is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you are doing now?
I have been told by a lot of people who have experienced me, either as a consultant or as an executive education specialist, a teacher, a mentor, that I have changed their lives. So what I hope to achieve is to help people see themselves and the world that they live in, hear themselves and the world that they live in different ways. And if I can help do that with even a few individuals, then I definitely think I would have started the seeds of a movement, because that's how change begins. It begins with ourselves. And so my commitment is to help those I come in contact with see and hear themselves and the worlds that they live in differently, in different ways that they had not previously imagined.
And finally, what is your life's purpose?
I'm reminded of that poem by Rudyard Kipling. If you can walk with kings but not sound too wise, or if you can walk with commoners and not sound too wise or not lose the common touch. So I have to be very honest with you. I find something like that very problematic. Again, not because I'm trying to be falsely modest, but my life's purpose is really reflected in what I have done. So I'd rather not claim it. I'd rather just point to it So having started a business, having created jobs, having taught, having been an educator, having been a mentor, and having changed people's lives by their admission, not by my own, having written books, planning to continue to write, to continue to teach, to continue to change lives, I think that's my life's purpose. And I'd rather point to what I've done than try and claim something that may sound too good, too wise, and may make me look better than who I really am.
I want to thank you again, Gaurav, for joining us here on the program. And this has been an extraordinary opportunity as well as experience for me. And I've learned some new things in regards to the ways in which you see things, and hoping to incorporate some of those into my own life. And we'll continue to encourage people to pick up a copy of your book, Awakening a Leader's Soul. Learnings through immortal poems. And again, thank you so much for taking so much time with us today.
Well, thank you very much, Richard. I enjoyed the conversation, and I sincerely hope your listeners did too.
I'm Richard Dugan. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Until next time, love to Lal.